It's 2:01 in the morning, Caracas, Venezuela. A mother jolts awake, not to her alarm, to explosions. The bedroom goes dark, the power grid gone. Through her window, she sees something she's only watched in movies about other countries, other wars, other people's nightmares. Black helicopters descending on the presidential compound. She grabs her daughter, runs to a neighbor's house. Later, she tells reporters, "I was crying. I wouldn't wish it on anyone." Now across the city, the same scene repeats. Families huddled in doorways, children asking questions parents can't answer. Smoke rising over Fort Tijuana, the country's largest military base. And somewhere in that chaos, a president, sitting president, is being pulled from his home, blindfolded, and loaded onto an aircraft. By 4:30 that morning, 2.5 hours after the first explosion, Nicolas Maduro is on an U.S. warship. By evening, he's on American soil. By Monday, he'll stand in a Manhattan courtroom. No trial in Venezuela. No extradition request. No negotiation. Just force. Now, here's where it gets uncomfortable. Maduro, well, he's not innocent. I'm talking about stolen elections, crushing dissent, a UN investigation documenting torture, disappearances, crimes against humanity. A US indictment alleging he ran Venezuela like a narco state, funneling cocaine northward for decades. So maybe you're thinking, good, he deserves it. But here's the question that should keep you awake tonight. Who decided? Not Congress. They weren't asked. Not the United Nations. They weren't consulted. Not the Venezuelan people. They woke up to their capital on fire. One man decided. One phone call authorized it all. One signature launched warplanes. And if that can happen to Venezuela, if a US president can bomb a sovereign nation, seize its leader, and announce he'll run the country until he decides otherwise, without a single vote from the people's representatives, then what exactly separates us from the autocrats we claim to oppose?
You're listening to Nelson John 360. Nelson John 360.
Hello and welcome back to Nelson John 360. I'm your host, Nelson John. This is my first episode for 2026. Wishing you a very happy new year. All right. Today, let's confront a question that has no comfortable answer. A question that American founding fathers debated. That the American founding fathers debated. That international law was built to prevent. And that one military operation just blew wide open. When does intervention become invasion? Let me repeat that again. When does intervention become invasion? When does justice become conquest? And can a democracy wage war without ever calling it one? The capture of Nicolas Maduro isn't just breaking news. It's a fracture line running through everything we know that we thought about power, sovereignty, and the rules that are supposed to govern both. Let's break this down together. Now, this operation began late Friday night, January 3rd, with President Trump authorizing what the Pentagon has since called the most sophisticated, most complicated, and most successful joint operation raids of all time. It's their words, not mine. Here's what we know from confirmed reports. The CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, had quietly embedded a small team inside Venezuela as early as August 2025, gathering what officials described as extraordinary insight into Maduro's movement, his habits, where he slept, what he ate, where he traveled. They had a human source inside Maduro's inner circle, someone feeding them real-time intelligence. The military buildup had been visible for months. The USS Gerald R. Ford, America's most advanced aircraft carrier, swept into the Caribbean in late 2025. According to multiple reports, Trump spoke directly with Maduro in a final phone call before the strike, essentially telling him to surrender. Maduro refused. That refusal sealed his fate. At 10:46 p.m. Eastern Time on Friday, Trump gave the final authorization. American forces disabled Venezuela's air defenses. Trump cryptically noted that the lights of Caracas were largely turned off due to a certain expertise that we have. Multiple explosions rocked the capital by 2:01 a.m. American choppers touched down at Maduro's compound. By 4:29 a.m., less than 6 hours after the operation began, Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Cecilia Flores, were aboard the USS Warship, en route to New York to face narco-terrorism charges. Trump posted a photograph on Truth Social showing Maduro blindfolded, wearing a gray tracksuit. Strikes hit at least 4 Venezuelan states, Caracas, Miranda, Aragua, and La Guardia. Reports indicate at least 40 Venezuelans died. 32 Cuban nationals present in Venezuela were also killed, according to Cuba's Communist Party. And here's where it gets constitutionally complicated. Yes, constitutionally. Congress was not consulted beforehand. No vote was held. No authorization for military force was passed. Top lawmakers, including those on the Intelligence Committee, learned about the operation only after it was already underway. So let's talk about what the Constitution actually says, because this really matters enormously. Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution gives Congress, not the president, yes, it gives the Congress and not the president, the power to declare war. This wasn't an accident of drafting. The founders deliberately split war powers between the executive and legislative branches precisely because they feared concentrating such awesome power in a single set of hands. The last time Congress formally declared war was in 1941 for World War II. Since then, presidents of both parties have initiated military actions using the Article II powers as commander-in-chief, usually with some form of congressional authorization, typically through what we call an Authorization for the Use of Military Force, or AUMF. Now, following Vietnam, Congress attempted to reassert itself through the 1973 War Powers Resolution. Now, this law requires the president to notify Congress within 48 hours of deploying troops into hostilities and to withdraw forces within 60 days, extendable up to 90 days in emergencies, unless Congress explicitly authorizes continued action. Now, here's the critical question. Was any of this followed with Venezuela? The evidence suggests not. Senator Tim Kaine, a Virginia Democrat who has led efforts to reassert congressional war powers, put it bluntly. Quoting him, "Maduro is terrible, but Trump put American service members at risk with this unauthorized attack." Secretary of State Marco Rubio defended the decision at a press conference alongside Trump, arguing that this was not the kind of mission that you can do congressional notification on. Trump himself cited concerns about leaks. Quoting Trump, "Congress has a tendency to leak. This would not be good." But here's the constitutional tension. The founders deliberately designed friction into the war-making process. The requirement for congressional debate wasn't a bug, it was a feature. It forces presidents to justify military action to the public. It requires lawmakers to tie their credibility to those plans. It creates accountability. When presidents bypass that process, they're not just circumventing political obstacles. They're removing that very safeguards that distinguishes democracies from autocracies. Now, this isn't the first time the United States has used military force in Latin America to capture a head of a state. The closest parallel occurred exactly 36 years earlier to the day. On January 3rd, 1990, General Manuel Noriega surrendered to American forces in Panama following the December 1989 invasion, which was known as Operation Just Cause. Like Maduro, Noriega had been indicted on drug trafficking charges in the United States. Like with Venezuela, the Bush administration argued it was combating narco-terrorism and protecting American citizens. But there are crucial differences that legal scholars are already highlighting. In Panama, American forces were already stationed there, more than 10,000 troops at the headquarters of Southern Command. The Panamanian General Assembly had formally declared a state of war against the United States. And critically, Panamanian Defense Forces had recently killed a U.S. Marine officer at a roadblock. So these facts gave the Bush administration at least a plausible self-defense argument. Venezuela presented none of these conditions. The United States had no troops stationed there. Venezuela had made no declaration of war. There was no imminent armed attack against American territory or forces. The military assets used in the operation, the Ford Carrier Strike Group, had to project power across the Caribbean, not deploy from existing positions. Even with the Panama precedent, legal consensus was never achieved. The War Powers Resolution arguably required congressional authorization that was never obtained. International law scholars at the time argued it violated the UN Charter's prohibition on the use of force. If Panama was legally contested, Venezuela appears even more so. The justification has shifted from protecting Americans and responding to attacks to something broader and more nebulous. Combating narco-terrorism conducted by a foreign government. Now let's examine the administration's core argument, because it raises profound questions about where military force can be used and against whom. The Trump administration has framed this operation as law enforcement, apprehending an indicted fugitive rather than warfare. Attorney General Pam Bondi announced that Maduro and his wife face narco-terrorism conspiracy charges, cocaine importation conspiracy, and weapons charges in the Southern District of New York. The indictment alleges that for over 25 years, Venezuelan leaders have abused their positions of public trust and corrupted once legitimate institutions to import tons of cocaine into the United States. It paints Maduro as head of the so-called Cartel de los Soles, the Cartel of the Suns, named for the insignias on Venezuelan military uniforms. The State Department estimated that between 200 to 250 tons of cocaine were trafficked through Venezuela annually by 2020. Now, these are serious allegations with significant documentation. But here's where the legal argument gets complicated. Professor Claire Flinkenstein of the University of Pennsylvania rejected the administration's framing directly, telling Al Jazeera, quote-unquote, "It was an act of war against Venezuela, and we did not have the kind of self-defense justification that would normally justify bypassing Congress." Representative Gregory Meeks, the top Democrat on the House of Foreign Affairs Committee, was equally direct, quoting him, "There was no imminent threat to the United States from Venezuela. certainly not one that justified military action without congressional authorization. And the administration's own intelligence contradicts some of its public claims. An April 2025 report from the National Intelligence Council stated that while Venezuela's permissive environment enables Tren Aragua to operate, the Maduro regime probably does not have a policy of cooperating with TDA and is not directing TDA movement to and operations in the United States. There's also the matter of Trump's recent pardons. Last month, he freed former Honduran president Juan Orlando Hernandez, who had been convicted in the U.S. for helping smuggling more than 400 tons of cocaine into the country. If narco-terrorism is the justification for invading Venezuela, critics ask, why pardon someone convicted of moving twice as much cocaine as Venezuela allegedly trafficked annually? The selectivity of enforcement raises questions about whether drug trafficking is the genuine motivation or a convenient legal framework for regime change. Now, whatever the domestic legal debates, the international law picture appears clearer to most experts. And it's not favorable to the United States. Article 2, 4 of the United Nations Charter, it states, let me quote that for you here, all members shall refrain in their international relations from the threat or use of force against the territorial integrity or political independence of any state. All right. Both the United States and Venezuela are parties to this treaty. The prohibition reflects customary international law binding on all nations. There are only two other recognized exceptions. Authorization by the UN Security Council under Chapter 7 or the inherent right of self-defense under Article 51. Well, neither of it apply here. The Security Council issued no authorization. The self-defense exception requires an armed attack, actual or imminent, against the defending state. Let's be clear here. Drug trafficking, however serious, has never been accepted as constituting an armed attack triggering military self-defense. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres expressed alarm, calling the operation a dangerous precedent and emphasized that the rules of international law have not been respected. UN General Assembly President Annalena Baerbock was more pointed, noting the charter is not an optional document and warning that a peaceful, safe, and just world for everyone is only possible if the rule of law prevails instead of might makes right. Professor William Brooke White of the University of Pennsylvania concluded that the strikes contravene the United Nations Charter-based prohibition on the use of force and the fundamental rules of humanitarian law. China's President Xi Jinping condemned what he called unilateral hegemonic bullying, stating that all countries should respect the development paths chosen independently by the people of other countries. Russia's foreign ministry labeled it as an act of armed aggression. Even traditionally close American allies will face difficult questions about whether and how to respond to what many international lawyers consider a clear violation of the post-World War II legal order. Now, this brings us to perhaps the most consequential question. What happens now? Trump announced that the United States will run Venezuela until there is a safe, proper, and judicious transition to new leadership. When asked about boots on the ground, he responded, "We're not afraid of boots on the ground." Venezuela's Supreme Court ordered Vice President Delcy Rodriguez to serve as acting president, but Trump has suggested the U.S. won't recognize her government unless she does what we want, which he clarified means total access to Venezuela's oil reserves. A Chatham House analyst noted, not regime change or democratic transition, but rather a decapitation of the Maduro regime. The Democratic opposition, led by Nobel Peace Prize winner Maria Corina Machado, supports American pressure. But supporting airstrikes from abroad is quite different from governing a fractured nation of 28 million people. A 2019 U.S. military exercise reportedly concluded that a U.S. intervention to oust Maduro would likely cause chaos. Criminal groups, Colombian insurgents, and others who backed Maduro would become what analysts call insurgent guerrillas. Congress returns next week with the Senate expected to vote on a bipartisan war powers resolution that would block using U.S. forces against Venezuela unless explicitly authorized. Whether it passes and whether Trump would comply remains uncertain. The constitutional stake here extends far beyond Venezuela. Each unchallenged episode becomes precedent for the next. If the United States can unilaterally deploy military forces to seize Venezuela's president, the question is, what prevents China from claiming authority to abduct American officials it considers criminals? What prevents Russia from doing the same? So where does this leave us? We're left with a sovereignty paradox that has no clean resolution. Maduro was, by many accounts, an authoritarian leader who stole elections, committed human rights abuses documented by UN investigators, and presided over narco trafficking that harmed American communities. Pretty sure few will mourn his removal from power. But the manner of that removal, without congressional authorization, without Security Council approval, in apparent violation of the UN Charter, challenges the very foundations of the international order that the United States itself constructed after World War II. Democracy requires friction. It demands debate, accountability, and the courage to justify actions to the public before taking them, not afterwards. The question here is whether Maduro deserves to face justice. The question is whether any president, this one or the next, should possess unchecked authority to wage war on another nation without the American people's representatives ever having a say. The answers we reach or refuse to reach will echo far beyond Caracas. They'll shape what kind of world we leave for those who come after us. That's all for today. Thank you for joining me here on the Nelson John 360 podcast. I'm your host, Nelson John. And thanks for thinking this through with me.